However, the in-depth interview was scrapped in favour of one of those shorter, pithier, what I've learned pieces, and a collection of my words was assembled randomly under topic headings that bore little relation to the context in which they were uttered. My life is so much better now that my father is not in it. He does have cancer, which apparently runs in the family. Maybe next time I see him he'll be really ill, or he'll be dying, and I may not see him, is how the Times mashup ran. No wonder the Sunday Mail was sniffing about. Every person in the public eye will have stories of media invasion and misrepresentation. As, sadly, there were no classes at drama school for dealing with these sorts of things, I, like many before me, fumbled my way through the years and finally developed my own way of coping with this part of my job and my life, mostly by trying to be open and honest. I tried to be guarded about parts of my personal life in the past, but realised the hard way that doing so came over as coyness and invited speculation. In 1999, the News of the World, the most vicious of tabloids in both its disdain for facts and its methods of accruing them, ran a story implying that I was accusing my father of sexually abusing me as a child. This was completely false. I had done no such thing, nor had my father. But again, a comment I'd made about the aftermath of playing Hamlet in an interview with the American magazine Out a few months prior had been seized upon, misquoted, sensationalised, and then deemed irrefutable evidence of an accusation of sexual molestation. Here's what I actually said. After Hamlet, I just suddenly changed my life. I was not divorced, but separated, and I also confronted my dad with my brother's help. We went and talked to my father about the things he'd done to us in our childhood. Hamlet was probably not totally the cause of that, but it unlocked boxes in my mind that were locked away in the attic, and they all came out and I had to deal with them. It caused a lot of pain to many people, including myself. The next day, the Daily Record, sister paper to the Sunday Mail, ran a story with the headline, "Father of Bisexual Star Alan Hits Back," in which my father angrily denied my non-existent accusations. As you might imagine, all hell broke loose. I was in New York at the time, about to attend the premiere of a film I was in, a remake of Annie. Talk about the universe throwing you a curveball. When I got a call from Mary Darling, who just had her irate ex-husband on the phone, he was understandably furious. Every single person he knew would have seen the story. It transpired that the News of the World had been camped outside his house, and now other publications were ringing his doorbell. I felt sick. My father had terrorised me, Tom, and Mary Darling throughout our lives and was physically, mentally and emotionally abusive, but he was no sexual molester. I was horrified. But my horror was not just about how awful it must be for my father to be falsely accused of such a terrible act, but also that his rage was, right now, directed once more at me. The same fear and anxiety I'd lived with as a child suddenly reconsumed my life. I could hear it in my voice as I spoke to my mother. I could hear it in hers. I could feel it within myself. But worst of all was the fact that my father might think I actually had accused him of these things. My father did not really know me. He had no way of contacting me, as we hadn't spoken in years at that point. He also had no experience of dealing with the press or understanding of their disregard for reason in pursuit of a scandal. In New York City, Cumming Jr. was smiling for the cameras in an Alexander McQueen ensemble between frantic phone calls to see what could be done to calm his father, comfort his mother, take the tabloids to task, and demand an apology for this slander. Cumming Sr., at home in Scotland, also did what he felt was right. He talked. To his credit, he said he didn't want to carry on a conversation with his son via the pages of a national newspaper. But of course, he was saying that in the pages of a national newspaper. Eventually, I was able to secure an apology from the Daily Record. My publicist had told me that there was no way I could take on the News of the World, which had a renowned, huge legal fund purely for quashing lawsuits from the aggrieved subjects of its stories, as well as the knowledge that anyone who wanted to pursue them had to countenance an already painful story being raked through the papers all over again should they go to court. And although the few contrite lines at the bottom of the Daily Record's letters page a few weeks later were a far cry from the screaming headlines of the original story, it was important to me for my father to know I had done all I could to right this wrong. I wanted to show him that I cared about such an intrusion to his private life, that I was doing what I could to protect him. Of course, at the same time, I was reminded that my father had never shown those kindnesses towards me, and I wondered how different such an intrusion would have felt if he had known immediately that he could pick up the phone, tell me there were reporters outside his door, and hear my advice and my reassuring words. So now, back in the lounge at Nice Airport, I listened to Mary Darling's lilting Highland tones and knew what to expect. Probably a gossipy, needling piece in that Sunday's Mail. No big deal compared with what had come before, but able to churn up old sadness nonetheless. "But don't you worry, pet," she said reassuringly. "I just said I couldn't help them, had no comment, and smiled and shut the door." My flight to London was called. I took a last sip of my Bloody Mary and thought to myself, tomorrow's chip paper. And it was true. By Monday lunchtime, the Sunday Mail would be used for wrapping up greasy bags of fries in chip shops all over Scotland. But by then, the damage would have been done. So much more damage than I could ever have countenanced. We ascended into a cloudless Mediterranean sky, and as I always tend to do when airborne, I smelled the roses. Maybe it's the fact that I hurtle through the sky in a metal-fatigued box so regularly, and therefore the odds of said box careering to a watery grave must be quite scarily higher than for the average traveller, that makes me count my blessings in this way. Or maybe it's the copious amounts of free booze. Whatever, it's another inexorable ritual. But I smell the roses not just to remind myself of how lucky I am, but also to wonder how on earth it all happened. I smell the roses to try and figure out how I came to be in the garden at all. Then. Nobody disliked the rain more than my father. All of a sudden, nature would not bend to his will. Time would not mould to his form. His meticulous plans would have to be altered. Men would have to be redirected to new, hastily created tasks. The rain brought chaos to his carefully constructed realm. And on this particular day, I would become the unwilling and, as usual, ill-informed brunt of his frustration. This day was the first time I truly believed I was going to die. I looked into my father's eyes and I could see that in the next few moments, I might leave the planet. I was used to rage. I was used to volatility and violence. But here was something that transcended all that I had encountered from him before. This was a man who had nothing to lose. The very elements were raging against him, and what was one puny little son's worth in the grand scheme of things? I felt like I was my father's sacrifice to the gods, a wide-eyed, bleating lamb that he was doing a favour in putting out of its misery. It was during my summer holidays from high school. I was old enough to be working for him full-time by then, but not yet fully grown enough to be sent to aid the men with their tasks. So not only was I feeble and weak and inept, I also, in this current downpour, demanded more time and planning and attention due to my inadequacies. It was always like this with the rain. I longed for it as respite from the back-breaking labour, but as soon as it came, I knew I was doomed. We'd been working outside in the nursery, separating the 1 and 2-year-old spruce saplings that were strong enough to be taken to the forests and planted from the runts of the litter. These, much like me, needed to be cast aside. The rain had necessitated that this work be postponed, and instead all the saplings were transported into the old tractor shed in the sawmill yard, where they could be graded and selected in a dry place. This, I was told, was to be my job. I was sent to the shed to await further instructions. There was a single bare light bulb hanging above me. I stood beneath it, surrounded by mounds and mounds of spruce saplings, hearing my father's voice come wafting through the gale as he ordered his men around. Finally, the shed door opened and a gust of wind and a clap of thunder heralded his entrance. In the light bulb's dim hue, his lumbering frame cast a shadow over me and much of the piles of baby trees. I remember the smell of them, so sweet, fresh, and moist. "You go through these," he said, picking up a handful of saplings, "and you throw away the ones like this." He thrust out a hand to me, but it was full of saplings of various lengths and thicknesses. With his shadow looming over me, I could barely discern the differences between any of them. "And you put the good ones into a pile over here," he gestured to his right. I looked up at him, blinking and windswept. "How do I know if they're good or not?" I asked. "Use your common fucking sense," he said from the shadows. A second later, a shaft of eerie grey-blue light filled the shed. Thunder vibrated beneath my feet and he was gone. For the next few hours, I sifted through the trees like a mole, blinking and wincing in the semi-darkness. After a while, the saplings began to blur into a prickly procession, spilling through my fingers. I would check myself and go back through the discarded pile at my feet and wonder if I'd been too harsh in my judgment. The pile of rejected saplings seemed to be bigger than the successful ones, and I questioned if my criteria was too harsh. Then pragmatism would win over, and I'd tell myself I needed to be ruthless, that this pile had to be shifted, and it never would be by prevaricating or becoming sentimental. Of course, my father had not given me much to go on to make my choices. He was usually vague and generalized in his instructions, but incredibly specific when it came time to inspect my work. But today was different. Perhaps because he was so preoccupied with the challenges the weather had created for him and his workers, he had doled out fewer instructions than usual about how I was to proceed. For instance, he gave no indication of what ratio of plants should be kept to those that should be rejected. He gave no clues as to the criteria I should use in filtering them, aside from that shadowy fist he had thrust in my face. I was standing in a freezing, damp, dark room, surrounded by thousands of baby trees. I began to panic. I did what I could. When my hands began to get numb, I pushed them between my thighs and held my legs close together to bring some life back into them. At times, I felt I was on a roll, but then the panic would set in. I would glance down at a mound of discarded trees and realize I'd been too hasty in my judgment. They seemed too healthy, too thick, too tall. But I couldn't save them all, could I? Every moment of doubt was compounded by the knowledge that I was wasting precious time, and before long, my father would return. And of course, he did. I heard him saying goodnight to some of his men, and my heart sank. With none of them around, he would have less motivation to rein in his fury. After a while, I heard his footsteps and the door open slowly. He stood for a second, silhouetted, dripping and silent, as though this was how he wanted me to remember him. I stood up from the bundles of plants and tried to ease back into the shadows. My father bent down to one of the piles I'd made, and without looking up at me, asked,
"What are these?"
"Rejects," I said questioningly. He sifted through them for a moment, and then, without warning, he backhanded me across the face. I flew through the air and landed in a heap against the stone wall of the shed. I was breathless and dizzy. The wind knocked out of me. I knew I had to get away. I began to run for the door, but my father grabbed onto my collar with one hand and smashed my mouth with his other. I fell to the ground. An instinct told me to stay there. I could tell he had only started. "What the fuck do you call this?" he railed. The storm raged outside, and it was as though my father was determined to belittle nature with his own wrath. I could only whimper, "I'm sorry." I didn't know what I was sorry for. I didn't know what he wanted. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. All I knew was that a line had been crossed. My face was throbbing, and the back of my head hurt from where it had landed against the stone wall. I was on my knees before him, and he was throwing plants on me, kicking me, and screaming at me. I had apparently rejected perfectly good saplings and at the same time retained puny ones that should have been destroyed. There was no rhyme or reason. All I could do was hope it would be over soon, but he continued to spew insult and bile and his body at me while the crash of the storm covered the sound. Suddenly, there were spikes in my eye, and I realized he had kicked me into a pile of saplings. And then I felt the dull thud of his boot against my tailbone, and my mouth was full of them too. I wanted to stay there, face down, curled into a fetal position, and let him finish me off. But the overpowering survival instinct took over, and before he could strike again, I turned round and fell to my knees before him, sobbing and beseeching, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I didn't know, you didn't tell me." I felt pathetic, but it stopped him in his tracks. "I didn't do it on purpose. I wanted to get it right, but you didn't tell me. I'm sorry. I won't do it again. I'm so sorry. Please." I was done. Nobody was coming to save me. And nobody cared. My body began to shudder and heave with such black grief that it surprised even me. The sound of the shed door banging shut opened my eyes. He was gone. After a while, I stopped crying. There were little trees stuck to my hair and in my mouth. My face was throbbing from his blows and my bum hurt from his boot. In the eaves of the attic room of the shed was a wooden hutch my father had built to house a pair of doves we had once been given years before. For some reason I wanted to go up there. I climbed the stairs and dropped to my knees, staring plaintively into the dark recesses of the empty coop. Time passed. The storm finally subsided. The numbness in my cheek ebbed into a swelling. Darkness fell. Still, I sat in a heap in front of the empty birdcage, tears flowing. I had thought earlier I might die. Now, once again, I wanted to. Friday the 21st of May, 2010, 5 p.m. In no time at all, I was in my London flat, having a laugh with friends. I was to be based there for the first week of shooting of Who Do You Think You Are, aside from the mystery trips I would be taking elsewhere. My old friends Sue and Dom were there to greet me, and I looked forward to catching up and having a laugh about the insanity of the night before in Cannes, each anecdote more sweet in its telling because it was now just that, an anecdote and not real life. I could relate the palpable drama after the auctioneer told Jennifer Lopez her dress made her look like an ostrich, but not have to see it or feel it. There would be no anxiety that the name of the celebrity I was about to announce would not be the same as the one who walked on stage. There would be no celebrities at all, in fact. Just me and my besties. Sue and I had met many years ago at the Donmar Warehouse Theatre in London. I was there playing Hamlet, immediately followed by my turn as the MC in Cabaret that later transferred to Broadway, and we had been best friends ever since. When people ask how we met, Sue likes to tell them she washed my undies. And indeed she did, for then she was a member of that most noble of professions, the theatre dresser. She was also, and is, totally gorgeous. Quite literally, actually. Her surname had originally been Gore, but she changed it legally to Gorgeous after years of it being her unofficial moniker. The actual document she had to sign to complete the name-changing process was hilarious, asking her to solemnly swear to renounce the name Gore and to be, from that day forth, forever gorgeous. And she has been. When she married Dom, I and our other bestie, Andrew, were male bridesmaids, stifling our giggles as Sue walked down the aisle to Elvis, singing It's Now or Never. As the wine flowed and the laughter rose, I felt the feeling I most enjoyed. Home. Then, Sue's phone rang. Hi, Tom, she said. Oh, he's here. He arrived about an hour ago. I wonder why my big brother would call Sue and not me to find out my whereabouts. Sue passed me her phone, and immediately I knew something was wrong. How are you doing? Tom asked, a little shaky. Obviously he hadn't intended to speak to me. I'm good, how are you? I replied cautiously. When am I going to see you then? Tomorrow night, remember, we're all having dinner, I said, referring to the plan for him, his wife Sonia, a bunch of my London friends, and me to meet up in my favourite Chinese restaurant the next evening. I really need to talk to you, Alan. There was silence for a moment. I tried to process what this meant. Well, why don't you come up a bit early tomorrow and have a drink with me at the flat before dinner? I said eventually. No, I need to talk to you sooner than that. Tom was trying to hold it together, but the cracks were beginning to show. Tom, what's wrong? I can't tell you on the phone, Alan. Is it your health? My mind immediately raced to the worst possible scenarios. My brother is a rock. If he acted like this, it meant there was really something badly wrong. Something happened between you and Sonia? No, no. I could hear Tom, even in the midst of whatever painful thing he was dealing with, trying to reassure me. It was what he had always done for me. Is something wrong with Mum? But I'd spoken to Mary Darling several times that week, and had listened to a message from her just that day. There was no way she could have hidden anything bad from me. Suddenly, I remembered what Mary Darling had said about the reporter. Is it something to do with that Sunday Mail guy looking for Dad? It's all come to a head, Alan, was Tom's response. I need to talk to you tonight. It took Tom 3 hours to get to me. He lives in Southampton and had to catch a train, and what with travel to and from the stations, I had to endure 3 whole hours of my mind racing and my heart thumping. Sue and Dom tried to distract me, but I could never wander far from the worry. What could possibly be making my brother so upset that he couldn't even utter it to me on the phone? I was a mess. my mind went to very dark places. The press being involved was a particularly disturbing element. If I'd had the ability at that moment to be rational, I would have realised that there was nothing particularly scandalous about my life that had not been revealed or touched on before now, and I might have taken solace from this added boon of having become an open book. But I was finding it hard to see solace anywhere. I started to get wheezy. I have asthma, and one of the times it comes on is during moments of great stress. Sue is luckily a self-confessed hypochondriac and an expert on all homeopathic remedies, so before too long I had a mouthful of pills to distract me. But still the nagging anxiety persisted, and still Tom hadn't arrived. He kept texting, "I'm on the train, I'm nearly at Waterloo, I'm getting in a taxi." I kept replaying our phone conversation. Had my father died? Was it something to do with my husband, Grant? He was heading home to New York City now. Could something have happened to him? But still at the root of it all was the reporter from the Sunday Mail and the fact that, as Tom had said, it had all come to a head. But what did that mean? By the time he arrived, I felt I'd aged 10 years. He entered the flat, looking remarkably normal. No tears, no visible signs of torment. If anything, he looked a little sheepish, as if he were embarrassed by all the fuss he must have known he'd caused by losing it on the phone. For a moment my heart leapt and I thought that maybe this revelation, whatever it might be, was not going to be as portentous and damaging as I'd feared. There were a few awkward moments of small talk, and then he looked at me. "Shall we go upstairs?" Then. When I was little, I was bullied by an older boy named David on the school bus. David's dad was the head carpenter on the estate where ours was the head forester. Tom, 6 years older than me and a year older than David, had graduated to high school by then, and we went our separate ways each morning. Tom went to Carnoustie and the swanky new high school, while I went to Manicky and the tiny Victorian stone grade school where there were only 6 people in my class. The bus I rode looked like something left over from the Second World War, and indeed, it was. It was a big, hulking, dark blue military transport type of thing, with 2 long benches that faced one another across a vast stretch of floor. The thing about that layout, of course, was that you could never look away from anyone. Everyone saw everyone else and everything that went on all the time. Every afternoon on the way home, and some mornings, I was kicked and pushed and slapped off the seat, my ears twisted back and forth, my books flung around and trodden on, the straps of my school bag held so I couldn't get away, and all the while, through my cries of pain and fear, his taunts that I had no big brother now to protect me were ringing in my red and sore ears. Luckily, the journey back to the estate gates was a short one, and as soon as the bus stopped, I leapt off and made a terrified bolt down the drive, much to the amusement of my tormentor and his little brothers. It was all very Lord of the Flies, and I was Piggy. David was a nice enough boy, and I realised now that his bullying of me that summer was just his way of establishing the new world order of the Manicky school bus. My brother had been the undisputed leader till he had ascended to high school, and so by terrorising me, David was not only defining himself as alpha male, but also as the new Tom Cumming. How better to show that your former leader's power is naught than by making his little brother cry? But then I was mad as hell and I was not going to take it anymore. I told Tom. Nothing much was said, just a tearful confession after he asked me if everything was going okay at school without him. I almost forgot about it, until one night we were cycling home from Cub Scouts. David and his siblings were in a gaggle ahead of us. Tom shouted out to David to wait up, and then told me to carry on home. "What are you going to do?" I asked, suddenly alarmed. "Just go home, Alan. I'll be there in a wee while." I did as I was told, pedalling fast and whizzing through the estate gates and down the driveway, through the sawmill yard to our house and into the bike shed. My heart was racing, my mind a whirl of what awful torture or bloodshed might be taking place at that very moment on my behalf. My parents didn't seem to pick up on my nervousness. My mum looked up from her ironing and asked where Tom was when I entered the living room, and my dad kept his gaze on the TV. Minutes later, Tom arrived, cool as a cucumber, and gave me a stony look that I knew meant we must never speak of this again. 5 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and I raced out to answer it, my heart now in my mouth. I opened the door to find David, weeping and clutching his already bruising eye, being held up by his irate mum. "Get your father!" David's mum yelled. My father ushered them in. Suddenly, out of nowhere, our living room was a courtroom and I was both the smoking gun and the cause of the crime. "Your son gave my son a black eye," David's mum shouted. "Well, Tommy, is this true?" our father yelled, even though I could tell he was secretly proud. "Yes, it is," Tom said, pulling himself up and embracing his sins. "But David's been bullying Alan on the school bus for months now." Everything stopped. David's teenage shame was now exposed for everyone to see. I felt so sorry for him, the skinny adolescent who'd shoved me off my seat and thrown my books around and held me down and whacked me countless times. He had never made me feel as mortified as I knew he now felt. Suddenly, I was shaken from my sympathetic reverie by the realization that the adults had stopped shouting. David had stopped crying. In fact, the whole room had stopped and was now looking at me, waiting for me to bring the whole sorry mess to some sort of conclusion. "Well, Alan," my dad said, "is this true?" The room fell quiet. I could feel my cheeks burning and everyone's eyes boring deep, laser-like into mine.
"No,"
I said meekly. Much as I wanted to defend Tom's tribal quid pro quo, I also felt so sorry for David, snivelling away, the bruise around his eye colouring darker by the second. It was just too much to deal with, and I chose what I thought was the lesser of two evils. As soon as I denied he was my tormentor, I'd burst into tears, and the adults mercifully realised they were putting a 9-year-old under too much duress, especially when there came no protestation of innocence from David. The clerks went home. I was comforted, and the matter was never mentioned again. In some way, there was an agreement between us all that justice had been served. An eye for an eye, or more like a black eye for a series of bruises and stingy ears. I told this story at my brother's wedding. His third, incidentally. We coming boys love a wedding. For me, it is emblematic of our relationship. Tom always the protective big brother, me in awe of the enormity of his devotion and screwing things up. Friday the 21st of May, 2010, 8 p.m. Almost 40 years later, Tom is sitting across the table from me on the roof deck of my flat, visibly shaking and seemingly incapable of beginning the speech that he knows is going to blow my world apart. He stammers and makes several false starts. I beg him to just say it, to just tell me. I'm going mad with the waiting. At first, he apologizes because he has already told Grant. Again, I can't process what that means. He says he didn't know how best to tell me, and so he called Grant for advice. Everything was whirring. My thoughts, Tom's voice, the skyline of Soho all around us. He finally manages to get out that our father had called him 10 days ago. "What did he say?" I whispered. I was shaking. I'd started to cry. I was in hell. "Please, Tom, please." Tom looked up at me, his blue eyes filled with tears too. He gulped, and finally he said it. "He told me to tell you that you're not his son." I learned something about myself that night, something I had no idea about. And about a month later, one sweaty afternoon on a terrace in southern Malaysia, I was reminded of it again. When I get really shocking news, my entire body tries to get the hell away as quickly as possible. Before I'd really processed what Tom had said, I found myself propelling backwards, knocking over the bench I was sitting on and careening away from my brother. It felt as though I needed to push this incredible information back, giving myself the space necessary to even contemplating it. Downstairs, Sue and Dom thought the sound they were hearing was Tom and me fighting and that a body had just been flung to the floor. "What do you mean?" I kept asking. Tom was holding me now, trying to calm me down. This information was so far from left field, it was not even in the field. To say it was the last thing I expected to hear was an understatement of an understatement. "You're not his son," he said again. Tom was crying too now, but he could see how overwhelmed I was, how much I needed more information and fast. "He called me a week ago, weeping," he began. "Dad called you? Dad called you weeping?" I spluttered. Nothing was making sense.
"Yes,
He said he was never going to tell you and was just going to leave you a letter in his will. But he knew you were doing the television show, and so he wanted to tell you to stop you being embarrassed in public by finding out that way, he went on. Tom was rubbing tears away with his thumb. I suddenly felt so sorry for him. He was still the big brother, my protector, and here we were once again, weeping and scared and clinging to each other. I thought our father had no power over us anymore. I was wrong. Find out what, Tom? Please try and tell me quickly. I'm scared. My heart is beating so fast. I think I'm going to have a heart attack. Indeed, my heart was pounding so hard, I felt the need to clutch both hands to my chest just to make sure it stayed inside my body. You're in shock, Tom said. Take deep breaths. He continued. He called me again this Thursday and apologized for being so hysterical on the phone the first time. He said he's on a lot of painkillers for his cancer and he thinks he must have overdone it, but he wanted to assure me, well, to assure you, that it was all true, and he was going to leave you a letter telling you everything in his will, but he wants you to know now, and he says if you ask Mum, she'll deny it, but he's willing to take a DNA test. Who is my father, then? I sobbed. Who is he? Tom said a name. It was not someone I knew, but a name I remembered as a family friend from long ago. From, in fact, the time and the place we lived when I was born. Just hearing that name made everything a bit less abstract. Its familiarity grounded me, and I began to calm down. My breathing became more regulated, my pulse slowed. This was real. It wasn't just a joke to hurt or scare me, like so many of my father's edicts from the past. It was real. What else did he say? He said that he and Mum were at a dance at the Burnham Hotel in Dunkeld. Mum was gone for a while, and this guy's wife said he was gone too, and Dad and the wife both started looking for them. They went all over the bar and the dance floor, and then they went through into the hotel and they saw them, Mum and the guy, coming out of a bedroom together. And then what? And then 9 months later you were born, he added, like he was telling me a really fucked up bedtime story. I couldn't quite believe that my father wasn't doing this just to hurt me. One last hurrah, if you will, before he died. And the timing of it. How could he possibly think that Who Do You Think You Are would focus on something so sensational and upsetting and undocumented? And then I remembered my father's experience of dealing with the media, and it made total sense. Was he actually trying to protect me for once? Of course, I also reasoned he would also be protecting himself. His cuckolding going public would dent the ego of a man like him immeasurably. I was not my father's son. It wasn't supposed to have happened like this at all. Tom had discussed it with Grant, and they both felt that I should be told when I was home in New York with Grant by my side. Tom planned to fly over in a couple of weeks once I'd returned from filming in South Africa and tell me in as calm and protected an environment as possible. Poor Grant, therefore, had known this secret for the last few days we were in Cannes, keeping it to himself and never suspecting that events would dictate that Tom would need to tell me so soon. What had happened was that the reporter from the Sunday Mail had found my father. Once again, the tabloid press had managed to cause havoc in our family. Earlier that day, Tom had been driving home when my father called him, fuming and ranting about a reporter outside his front door. It's difficult to express the intensity of my father's rage. I'm sure that even as a dying man, it would be terrifying. Suddenly, Tom saw a police car parked on the side of the road, and so took the phone away from his ear for a moment. When he picked it up again, our father was still railing, so Tom assured him he would deal with the matter and hung up. He panicked that our father's suspicions were correct and that the imminent shoot of my Who Do You Think You Are had indeed prompted the news of my true lineage to somehow be leaked, and the idea that I might find out the news by seeing it splashed across the front page of a newspaper horrified him. He decided he had to tell me that night and called Sue to find out what time I was arriving. After he'd spoken to me, he finished his journey home and then called our father back to tell him he'd set the wheels in motion and was on his way to tell me everything before I found out via the press. Of course, this is when our father had told him that the reporter hadn't mentioned anything about who my real father was, but had in fact merely wanted a comment about that Times article. Our father's fury was actually directed at me for having mentioned he had cancer, not that this massive secret had been exposed. Tom was distraught, but now it was too late, and he had no choice but to follow through. What about Mum? I asked. Did you talk to her about it? Not yet, said Tom. I wanted to let her know I was going to tell you, but I didn't get a chance. Don't, I blurted. Don't talk to her until this is all sorted out in my head. Our family had always been one of secrets, of silence, of holding things in. The fact that my mother had never told me this, even in the decades since she and my father had divorced, was, perhaps surprisingly, not a surprise to me. She must have had her reasons, I thought. And whatever they were, I respected them, right now at least. It was incredible to think of my mother being the one who had strayed, when it was my father's infidelity that had so upset me as a child. Perhaps my mum's silence was even to protect my father, something we all seemed unremittingly conditioned to do. She was the most loyal person I knew, and if they had made a pact to stay silent all those years ago, it was no surprise that finally the one to break it would be him. Although I was shell-shocked by the news, I was also so glad my mother had someone else in her life, some love, someone who hopefully treated her with kindness and tenderness. If I was the product of that, it couldn't be such a bad thing, I decided. Tom told me more of what our father had said in the phone call, how he had suspected my mother of having an affair with this man, and how, when he had seen them come out of the hotel room that night all those years ago, he merely said, "Well, there's no point in staying here any longer," grabbed her by the arm and marched her home. It was never spoken of again. "Well, there's no point in staying here any longer." That was exactly the kind of thing I would expect my father to say in that situation. Something gruff, uncaring. Though I'd never imagined the idea of my father being in a situation where he would be the one discovering his spouse's infidelity. You see, my father was a big philanderer. His disregard for his wife's feelings, and indeed anyone who knew him, by the audaciousness of how openly and often he paraded his infidelity, was almost autistic in its terrible repetition, and it still manages to shock me. Everyone knew. Even when I was at primary school, I was aware that he was having affairs. I can't remember exactly how I came to know, but I do remember the first time I recognised the pain that knowing gave me. I was 8 years old, sitting on the grass of the playing field at Manicki Primary during lunch break. A little girl from my class was threading a daisy chain nearby. "Why are you sad, Alan?" she asked me out of the blue. I hesitated, slightly shocked that my sadness was palpable. I realised I needed to learn how to hide my feelings better, even outside the home. My training in the ways of the actor came early, you see. I wasn't sure how to articulate it. "Today is my mum and dad's wedding anniversary and they're not celebrating it," I said finally, a dry lump in my throat. It was true, but it wasn't the whole story, of course. Somehow I understood that the whole truth was shameful and must not be spoken of. I understood that I had to collude, to protect my father, even though he didn't deserve it. My father continued to have affairs throughout my childhood, and they were not subtle or discreet. He had no shame about parading his conquests in public. Sometimes even at the rare events, our whole family, albeit separately, would attend. I remember a barn dance at a farm down the hill and watching my mother's face as my father arrived with another woman in tow. At school, I would hear little comments and jokes about his affairs. One of them was actually a teacher of mine. Now, decades later, it was all beginning to make sense. Was his brazen disregard for my mother's and anyone else's feelings about his affairs due to the fact that he felt justified because my mother had committed the original sin? And was this the reason for her stoic acceptance of his behaviour too? It certainly explained the way he treated me. Hundreds of flashbacks of acts of violence and humiliation were being replayed in my mind. Now I saw them through a filter of knowing that my very existence was a reminder to my father of betrayal, even of his failure. But as Tom pointed out, our father was an equal opportunity abuser, and I was not alone in my place as his target. Our father was just as harsh, irrational, and violent to Tom. I felt a bit calmer, even though there were still mental fireworks going off inside my head. I needed to make a plan. I knew that the shockwaves of this news would not be confined to this evening. The repercussions of this bombshell would reverberate in my life for a long time to come. "And there's another thing," Tom said. I looked up at him with dread. "Dad's considering talking to the mail." What? I couldn't believe this could get any more awful. Not about you not being his son, Tom clarified. Well, what then? He's angry that they know about him having cancer, and they're telling him he should have his say about you before he dies. Tom's voice trailed off. Oh, perfect. Well, good luck to him, I said. If he wants to go down that road, that's his decision, but he'll regret it for the rest of his life. He has no idea what shit they'll make up. I couldn't believe it. Any of it. But at least, I was not my father's son. I felt like someone had died. And I suppose in a way someone had. My father was dead. Or at least the father I assumed to be mine, both literally and physically. I felt like I had created a narrative about my father over the last 45 years, and now I was mourning its death. I needed to give myself some time. I needed to recover. I knew I would have to eventually speak to both my parents, but I couldn't fathom that yet. The idea of contacting my new father was too daunting to even think about. I also wanted to get off the roof. It was getting dark now and cold. I was shivering, whether from the cold or pure shock, I didn't know. I knew that Sue and Dom would be worried sick. I wanted to put them out of their misery. Tom and I had been up there for ages, and I wanted to actually speak the words to another human being to make them real. We went down and told Sue and Dom, and spent the rest of the night talking and drinking and marvelling at the insanity that can descend in an instant. Mostly we talked about memories from our childhood, horrible moments we had shared, somehow trying to tie them to what we now knew, reassessing and realigning. Tom stayed over that night. We both bunked down in the sleeping loft at the very top of the flat. We were spent, dazed, cried and talked out. We said goodnight and I switched the light off, but after a while, I could feel him still awake across from me. "You know, Alan, you're lucky," he whispered. "You're lucky you're not his son." "I know," I said.